Part 1. Listen. Chapter 1. Old Blocks and Young Chips. Leadership lessons begin at home. Sometimes the greatest leadership lessons can come from the most unexpected places. Some elements of leadership are almost certainly genetic, and there is no escaping the fact that we are all products of our upbringing and our environment. As the saying goes, an apple never falls far from the tree that bore it. Well, as anyone who knows my mother Eve or my late father Ted will testify, I am certainly no exception to the rule. I recognize a lot of traits in myself that I have clearly inherited from my parents, mostly good, although just a few of the things that drove me nuts about my mum and dad when I was a kid almost certainly had the same effect on my own children. From my first memories of her, my mum was always on the go, buzzing around the place. She had a seemingly limitless imagination for coming up with new business ideas. I don't recall her ever considering herself an entrepreneur. That was probably only because I don't think the word existed back then, and if it did, nobody knew what it meant. But she was certainly the definition of enterprising. Eve is a human whirlwind. No matter what the latest big thing was, she'd always manage the whole process by herself, from developing the ideas to crafting the products to making deals with distributors, delivering and selling the goods. Nobody else could get in her way. It was her show and hers alone. I remember being very impressed by one of her more successful ventures, which was building and selling wooden tissue boxes and waste paper bins. This one made it to some fairly swanky stores, but they were generally more local ventures. She was absolutely tenacious and taught me never to cry over spilt milk. If an item didn't sell, she'd just write it off, learn from the experience, and quite dispassionately move on and try something else. My sisters and I were always being dragged in as unpaid child labour, a labour of love, she'd call it. All the household chores would be delegated to us while Mum was in manufacturing mode. Obviously, I didn't realize it at the time, but there was unquestionably a lot of osmosis going on in that house that would stand me in good stead later in life. Eve hasn't changed much, even though she is now... Oops. As she was the one that taught me never to talk about a woman's age, let's leave it at she is rather well into her 80s. In her early life, she had a spell as a West End dancer, and later became a stewardess for British South American Airways. That was in the really glamorous days of flying when they had to don oxygen masks to cross the Andes. To this day, she just never stops moving. I don't exactly lead a sedentary life myself, but I swear that sometimes I have trouble keeping up with her. One recent example was when, quite out of the blue, she casually announced her intention to organize a charity polo match. Not exactly the kind of thing one expects from an octogenarian. But this wasn't going to be something on the village green near her home. She was planning to do it in Morocco. Surprised, but far from stunned, I told her in no uncertain terms that I thought it a really crazy idea. Not only would it be a huge amount of work, but it would probably end up costing her money rather than raising it. She listened intently to what I had to say, and then went ahead and did it anyway. Not only did it happen, but it was a huge success and raised about $250,000. So while I was denied the opportunity to say, "See, Mum, I told you so," I really had to admire her tenacity, and so instead simply said, a very quiet, "Well done, Mum." Another of those family signature characteristics that I am told I have inherited is forever insisting on getting the last word in on any given subject. Well, just to show how flexible I can be on such things, I am going to let Eve have some of the first words in this book, so, as a published author herself, I invited her to write a few thoughts. Based on what I've just told you about her, see if any of the following sounds familiar. Apples and trees. Dear Ricky, if you're really going to let me say something in your next book, then here it goes. We saw it in you from virtually the first moment you began to talk, but even before that, when you learned to walk, we realized we were going to have our hands full. You were just a toddler, but you were clearly someone who liked to do things his own way and on your own terms. To make matters even more interesting, as you grew, you perpetually had some crazy new scheme or other up your sleeve that you were convinced was either going to change the world, make lots of money, or both. On a few such occasions, we would say things like, "Oh, don't be ridiculous, Ricky, that's never going to work." More often than not, however, your father and I instead opted to give you plenty of scope to learn by your mistakes, and so left you to get on with your Christmas tree growing, bird breeding, and all the other weird and wonderful enterprises you came up with. Almost without exception, they all ended in some form of a disaster, with us picking up the pieces, literally and metaphorically. But we'd soldier on and just kept hoping that one day the lessons learned would help you in life. And that certainly would seem to have turned out to be the case. After a rocky beginning, once you and Virgin had become an established success, Ted and I would often ponder on just how differently you might have turned out had we been more controlling, or some might say, better, parents. What if we had insisted that you not take so many silly risks, and rather than allowing you to drop out of school at 16, forced you to buckle down and complete your education? Like your headmaster at Stowe, who famously, now, predicted that by 21 you would either be in jail or a millionaire, we too shared some very serious misgivings about what the future might have in store for you. As we now know, of course, we needn't have worried. What we saw as being a pig-headed little boy who was utterly determined to do his own thing turned out to be nothing more than the growing pains of a budding entrepreneur. If only we had been able to recognize that at the time, we might have had a lot fewer sleepless nights. Love, Mum. I read that some wag once said of me, "That Branson chap is the luckiest person I know. You just watch. If he ever falls off a high building, he's almost certainly going to fall upwards." Please don't hold your breath on this one, as it's not a theory I intend to test any time soon. Others have suggested that I was simply born lucky. Perhaps. In my opinion, luck is a highly misunderstood commodity. It's certainly not something that drops out of the heavens. You really can work at helping it along, but more on that later. For now, suffice it to say that I came into this world a lot luckier than most people. I had the good fortune to be born into a wonderfully loving family where I enjoyed a safe and sensible childhood in post-war England. I grew up in a home where there were few, if any, excesses, but at the same time my two sisters and I never really wanted for much of anything, especially affection and guidance from our parents. Looking back on that period of my life, I have to heap praise on the stalwart efforts of my mother and father, as I certainly was not the easiest child to bring up. Apart from being dyslexic, I was blessed with an indomitable spirit that, whether she wants to admit it or not, unquestionably came from my mother Eve's side of the family. Perhaps she recognized this kindred spirit in me as she was constantly taking the lead in trying to keep young Ricky, that would be me, in line. At the same time, it was also very much a team effort with my father Ted, even if the two of them didn't always realize it at the time. There are many examples of this. Like one Sunday in church, when I point-blank refused to sit next to the son of a friend of my mother's, simply because I didn't like the child. Despite my mum's loudly whispered protestations, I instead sat with a friend on the opposite side of the aisle. I really didn't think it was that big of a deal, so I was utterly shocked when I got back home and, for what might have been the first time ever, my mother insisted that Dad should spank my bottom. She loudly proclaimed that The boy has to learn that such behaviour will simply not be tolerated in this house. As I was thinking, but I didn't do it in this house, Dad dragged me out of the room by the scruff of the neck, and then, just loudly enough to ensure that Mum would hear him, proclaimed, "Okay, young man, it's time for me to teach you a lesson that you'll never forget." And he certainly did. Following his quickly whispered instructions, I squealed in an appropriately pained manner as my dad proceeded to loudly clap his hands together half a dozen times. In a conspiratorial whisper, he then told me to go back in to see Mum and apologize while looking suitably chastised. It was all I could do to keep my face straight when, mid-apology, Dad gave me a huge wink from behind Mum's back. Dad was really just a big softy at heart, but I am convinced that the way he handled the situation after church that day taught me a far more lasting lesson than a severely bruised bottom and ego could ever have achieved. I'm not sure if my mother ever knew about the fake spanking. If she didn't, then when she reads this, she certainly will. But there was another, more serious occasion when Ted's parenting skills have stuck with me forever. On the odd occasion, I had been guilty of helping myself to a few pennies from the loose change that Dad used to unload from his pockets into the top drawer in his bedroom wardrobe. To my childish amusement, I had also discovered it was the same drawer where Dad kept his secret stash of what we used to call dirty books, but I digress. Helping myself to his change was never something I saw as stealing, per se. In my juvenile mind, I was just kind of borrowing it, and we'd simply never established the repayment terms or structure. As it turned out, however, I was the one who was about to get repaid by getting myself into a lot of trouble. We lived just around the corner from a sweet shop, and I'd been using my ill-gotten gains to buy chocolate, with Cadbury's Fruit and Nut being my particular favourite. One day, though, I'd taken a much bigger loan than usual from Dad's wardrobe bank and promptly done my part to boost Cadbury's shareholder value. The old lady who owned the shop, who at the time was probably all of 40 years old, quickly smelled a rat. She said nothing to me, but the next time I was in her shop in the company of my father, she staggered me by blurting out, "Now, I don't want to get him into any trouble, Mr. Branson, but I don't know where young Richard's getting all his money from. He's becoming quite my best customer, so I do hope he isn't stealing it." I remember her words like it were yesterday, and thinking, did she really have to put that zinger on the end? But then, just as I was thinking, oops, I'm really in for it now, my dad staggered me by putting his nose right up to hers, looking her straight in the eyes, and loudly declaring, "Madam, how dare you accuse my son of stealing?" I was even more surprised when, after we'd marched out of the shop, he never said another word about it. Sometimes, though, the power of the unspoken word can be a frighteningly powerful thing, and my father's studied silence with me for the rest of that day spoke volumes. In addition, the fact that he'd immediately jumped in and vehemently defended his light-fingered son's integrity made me feel more guilt-ridden and miserable than if he had berated me in front of her. Dad's handling of the situation certainly taught me a hugely effective lesson. Not only did I never pinch another penny from my parents, but it also taught me a life lesson on the power of forgiveness and giving people a second chance. I'd like to say the incident also taught me the importance of giving the benefit of the doubt, except in that particular case my father was in no doubt whatsoever as to precisely what had been going on. Some business leaders have built their personal brand images and businesses around their quirkiness and outspoken eccentricities, be they hard-nosed, authoritarian, or just downright crotchety. Michael O'Leary, CEO of the Irish airline Ryanair, once described his ideal customer as someone with a pulse and a credit card. And in the same Lunch with the Financial Times interview, referred to the British Airports Authority as the evil empire and the UK's Civil Aviation Authority as a bunch of cretins and twerps. While nobody can question Ryanair's incredible financial success, last time I checked, the low-cost carrier had built a market cap of over $13 billion. Being voted Europe's least liked airline by TripAdvisor subscribers is something that would not sit well with me, no matter how good the bottom line looks. American property magnate Donald Trump is another controversial character who seems to be either loved or hated by the consumer and is perhaps most famous for his "You're fired" line, something he seems to delight in telling people on his TV show The Apprentice. Unlike both these very successful gentlemen, I have always believed there are tremendous upsides to a more conciliatory approach to life and business, an attitude that even Michael O'Leary is now publicly proclaiming he wants his much-maligned airline to assume, although it remains to be seen whether or not this particular Celtic tiger can change his stripes. I'm not a betting man, but if I were, I'm not at all sure I would put money on this one. While I wouldn't be foolish enough to pretend that Virgin's three airlines have never had passengers with valid complaints, or that I have never fired anyone, I can honestly say that, unlike Mr. Trump, the latter is not something I have ever taken the slightest pleasure in doing. On the contrary, I will usually move heaven and earth to avoid letting someone go, as when it comes to such a last resort, I feel both sides have somehow failed each other. It's so much better, where possible, to try and forgive offenders and give them a second chance, just like my mother and father did so often with me as a child. I had a very similar incident to my sweet shop experience much later in life, only this time it was me who got to play the role of my dad. One day, while sitting at Virgin Records, I took a phone call from the owner of a nearby record shop who wanted to tip me off to the fact that one of our employees, whom he named, had been offering him piles of brand new Virgin Records at suspiciously low prices and on a cash-only basis. When he signed off with the words, "I just hope he's not stealing them," I had a definite déjà vu moment as my mind flashed back to my identical sweet shop indictment as a boy. Sadly, the person that the record shop man named happened to be someone we considered to be one of our brighter young A&R people, and much as I dislike these kinds of confrontation, on this occasion I had no option but to haul him into the office and repeat what I had just been told. The poor guy went bright red and was clearly horribly embarrassed, but he made no attempt to deny or defend his actions, opting instead to simply apologize profusely and say there was really no excuse for his behavior. Rather than firing him on the spot, however, as he had every right to expect, on the spur of the moment I opted instead to tell him that although he had let himself and the company down very badly, we were going to give him a second chance. The look of stunned amazement on his face said it all, and from that day on he worked his socks off for us and went on to have a stellar career, personally discovering some of Virgin Records' most successful artists along the way, Boy George being just one of them. When it comes to needing a second chance, however, nobody needs it more than ex-prisoners who are looking to restart their lives after they have served their time. The sad thing is that if they are honest and tick the criminal record box on an employment application form, they'll seldom get an interview, let alone a shot at landing the job. Ironically, the result tends to become one huge self-fulfilling prophecy. When they can't find employment, statistics show that 50% or more of ex-offenders take the seemingly easy way out and resort to crime as the only way to support themselves, and then quickly end up back inside. My good friend and comic relief creator Jane Tewson was the one who first drew my attention to the sad plight of ex-cons. In the process, Jane even succeeded in doing something I have worked long and hard at avoiding. She had me put behind bars. Actually, it wasn't the first time, but we don't need to go into that right now. Suffice it to say that Jane encouraged me to see firsthand the challenges prisoners face when attempting to re-enter the workforce by voluntarily spending a day in jail with them. In late 2009, I duly served my day in a high-security prison in Melbourne, Australia, and it certainly opened my eyes to the problem ex-prisoners have re-entering society, something about which I had never given a moment's thought. While down under, I also met with an inspiring group of leaders from the Toll Group, Australia's largest transportation company. I learned how they had been trying to do their bit to improve the lot of recently released prisoners, and had hired almost 500 of them over the previous decade, a number that represents about 10% of the company's workforce. The truly inspirational part of what they told me, though, was that not one of their former inmates had, to the best of their knowledge, ever reoffended. I have since constantly encouraged all of the Virgin companies around the world to work hard at following Toll's example. In the UK, we have been cooperating closely with the charity Working Chance, which since 2007 has taken the lead in working to place female ex-prisoners back into gainful employment, thereby breaking the cycle that can turn one little mistake or bad decision into a life sentence, whether in or out of prison. Last time I checked, Working Chance had placed almost 200 female ex-prisoners with Pret-a-Manger, Sainsbury's, and a variety of Virgin companies like Virgin Trains and Virgin Management. Perhaps the biggest irony here is that in 1971, but for the good graces of a British magistrate, I might well have had a prison record myself. I was caught red-handed by customs and excise officers in the act of ingeniously, or so my naive teenage self had thought, manipulating purchase taxes on the export and import of record albums. It was only by way of my parents generously posting the family home as collateral for my bail, and then my fully paying off the hefty fine I'd been given, that I managed to avoid being stuck with a criminal record. Had I actually done time and been branded as an ex-con, then the chances are very real that Virgin might never have happened, and the tens of thousands of jobs we have created would never have existed. Had I gone to jail for my stupid teenage error of judgment, I would have been the same person as the one who, luckily, did not end up behind bars, but I would almost certainly have been stigmatized by society and almost certainly have led a very different life as a result. Speak no evil. In our living room at home, my mum and dad used to have one of those peculiar little statues of the three wise monkeys, you may have seen them, that embody the proverbial principle of see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. Well, while there wasn't a lot they could do about the see no evil part, they went to great lengths to teach me to never think or speak badly of others. They encouraged me to always look for the good in people, instead of assuming the worst and trying to find fault. If they ever heard me gossiping or talking someone down, they would have me go and look at myself in a mirror for 5 minutes, the idea being that I should see how such behavior reflected badly on me. I was also taught that fits of pique or any outward displays of anger or rudeness never serve any useful purpose, and if anything, play only to your disadvantage. It was a lesson that stuck, and to this day, I frequently have people say things to me like, I really don't know how you could be so pleasant with those people. Or, if I were you, I'd have been really angry about what they just did. When in fact, I had just bottled up my emotions. The thing my parents didn't make any effort to teach me was how to keep my obvious delight at something under wraps, the downside of which is that it doesn't help my poker game very much. Whether we like it or not, however, we are all very much the product of our upbringing and our environment. After my little church incident, had my father handled the moment differently and put me across his knee, I would probably still remember the spanking, but would have long forgotten what it was for. The importance of the leadership lessons we absorb from our parents and in due course pass along to our own children and those with whom we work cannot be understated. I have always viewed the maturation of companies as being very much like that of young people. When they are newborn or toddlers, they tend to get away with all kinds of stuff on the basis that they are just finding their feet, and so they generally enjoy a higher forgiveness factor. If companies survive this stage, many do not, like teenagers, they then start to develop acne and other character blemishes while they get a little bit cocky and know-it-all. After that, there comes a more mature stage. They have hopefully learned from their mistakes and settled down, but this period is filled with very different kinds of risks, with complacency possibly being the biggest. And once a company reaches the midlife crisis stage, it easily gets lazy, overweight, set in its ways, and like adults, can spend more time looking in the rear-view mirror than forging new ways forward and trying to see what's around the next corner. From a leadership perspective, shepherding a company through each of these various stages of growth is not that different to bringing up a child. Just as raising a toddler is very different to keeping a teenager on track, and the skill sets may change a little as the company gets older, the fundamentals of parenting and corporate leadership are very closely intertwined. I was reminded of this fact when I recently overheard a friend of mine, who has three incredibly rambunctious young sons, playfully threaten his youngest, 11-year-old Charlie, that if the going ever got tough, on the basis of last in, first out, he'd be the first one to be let go. I laughed out loud, but it was the boy's immediate response that really struck home with me. With a big, impish smile, he looked his father right in the eye and retorted, "But Dad, why would you do that? If you think about it, I am much cheaper to keep because I don't eat nearly as much as my older brothers do." The inescapable fact is that learning and leadership are two-way streets, and even the oldest and wisest block can pick up a lot from the most junior of chips. Sadly, my father and best friend Ted Branson passed away in early 2010 at the grand old age of 93, leaving a huge hole in his family's lives. He certainly left his mark on me, and but for his wisdom and restraint on more than one occasion, those marks could quite deservedly have made sitting down a very painful process. Having given my mum the chance to chime in earlier, I am also going to let her have the last word, something she always enjoys. I very much doubt that she will remember saying it, but I certainly have never forgotten the sage advice my mother gave me after a school cricket match. I loved cricket and was generally pretty good at it, but this had been a game in which I had an uncharacteristically timid outing with the bat, and before I'd contributed a single run I was clean bowled without so much as a wave of the English willow. Driving home afterwards, Mum surprised me with her cricketing wisdom when she said, "Ricky, as I'm sure you'll agree, that wasn't really one of your better performances out there this afternoon. In future, just remember one thing. You're guaranteed to miss every shot you don't take." It was years later before I realized She had probably been talking about a lot more than just cricket.